understanding classical mechanics and classical field theory by thinking about the phase space, and we'll talk about some aspects of quantum field theory and perturbation theory as well. And you might have seen some of these the ideas we're discussing in this class before, but I'm going to be taking a more mathematical approach to these topics, so I think there'll be lots that is new. So given a Lagrangian system, so the phase space is a classical Hamiltonian system. And that's equivalent. So this chalk is not very good. Can you guys read what I'm writing? Yeah. So what do I mean by a classical Hamiltonian system? So I think we should have covered this in Giuseppe's lectures, right? So by that I mean the phase space is a symplectic manifold M. Often infinite dimensional. If I start with a classical field theory, this will be infinite dimensional with a Hamiltonian function on it. I wanted to give this course, even though some people might have seen this construction before, is there's a very clean and conceptual way to build the phase space from the Lagrangian, which is not as widely known as it should be. So the phase space, this is the slogan, is always the space of solutions to the equations of motion on whatever your space manifold is times or. Okay, so this is always what the phase space is. So you may have seen somebody tells you we have to do the Legendre transform, and somebody else tells you you need to do the, I don't know, covariant phase space method, but whatever. This is always what it is. And there's various ways to figure this out, but this is always the way to think about it. So suppose you were to go away from this lecture and you were good at general relativity, and you manipulated your equations for a while, you would find the ADM phase space pretty quickly, for instance. Phi of t, a field which depends only on time, and with this Lagrangian. So to start with, we're going to do something very simple and compute the space of solutions to the equations of motion of this Lagrangian. So if we vary phi, we find, of course, the equation that momentum is conserved. So the space of solutions to the equations of motion, so like phi of t is going to be equal to q plus p of t. So the space of solutions to the equations of motion is or 2 with coordinates in Q. Okay. So how do we figure out how do we derive a symplectic form? So there's a general formula for building the symplectic form. So to get there, I need to remind you of something very familiar, I'm sure. The Euler-Legrand equations are that S phi plus delta phi equals S phi plus delta phi squared, where delta phi goes to 0, t equals minus infinity plus infinity. So just keep this in mind. The variation has to go like that. Satisfies the equations of motion, we can consider the action functional on an interval. This we can do in any, I'm writing it in this system, but this is, of course, whatever Lagrangian system you do, we can just consider what happens if I integrate the Lagrangian only over some interval of time. And let's vary it. So I'm going to add on some other delta phi also satisfies the equations of motion. So what we're going to find, well, we draw a little picture. This might be my delta phi. And can be written as a piece near zero plus a piece near one plus a piece in the bulk. Well, because phi satisfies the equations of motion, the bulk term vanishes. Therefore, the variation is going to be a contribution from zero minus a contribution from one. Okay, I think I'm going a little fast. So again, this is something one can do with any system. We study the action function on this finite time interval, and I take some solution to the equations in motion, I vary it, you get some contributions from initial time and final time. And from this, we're going to build the symplectic form. Okay. Before I write down the symplectic form, I want to check I'm not going too fast. So are there any questions?
About this, so can I think of it that like I can split that first term S01 of phi plus delta phi into bulk and two boundaries?
Yes.
And then the bulk is killed by the. Why is there then a minus between?
That's just my decision as to what I want to call alpha one. But really, if we're actually to calculate this in a concrete example, you'd see. This integral, when I vary phi, picks up boundary terms because it's a total derivative, and they appear with different signs because I'm integrating along. Okay, so what is alpha zero? Like, what kind of object is it? So if M is the phase space, alpha zero depends on some phi and delta phi, depends linearly on delta phi. So alpha zero is a section of the cotangent bundle of M. I.e. a one form. So Giuseppe, you guys discussed differential forms to some degree, right? Like one forms and okay. And then the symplectic form, omega, symplectic form. Is omega. Is d alpha zero. So omega is a two form. So I'm going to derive the symplectic form for our simple example of just a free particle. But what's nice about this is that you can, you know, take Yang-Mills theory, and you could, well, it's tricky, but you could figure out the phase space in principle just by following this simple method. Okay. So the example of minus a half interval phi del t squared phi, well, the variation is minus a half interval from 0 to 1 of del phi del t squared phi plus phi del t squared del phi. So we've seen that this integral only acquires boundary terms. So this has to be a total derivative. And it turns out it is. I tend to make like typos in these explicit calculations, especially when I'm close to the blackboard. I'm doing something dumb. Yeah. Well, maybe it's better to write the Lagrange this way. Same. And there's factors of a half drop out. Yeah. It's just the total derivative of this. But there's several ways to do this analysis. Let's write the Lagrange unit this way. Okay. Great. Now the derivative in t at phi, so therefore, well, the variational one form is just this piece here, minus del phi del t phi. Since phi at 0 is q, phi prime at 0 is b. Uh, we find that the variation of one form is minus dqp, so that the symplectic form is minus dp dq, which is the usual answer. Okay, everybody reasonably happy with this computation? Okay, this is all very simple. So what about the Hamiltonian? Well, the answer here is the space of solutions to the equations of motion has a time translation. Which I'll call del t. If I have a solution to the equations of motion, I can just move it along in time and still a solution. So the Hamiltonian is the thing that generates this symmetry. That is, that the Poisson bracket width of h with any function f okay so I yeah
so what we found here is that like symplectic form is determined by equations of motion and initial conditions, right?
I wouldn't say initial conditions, right? The phase space kind of is the Cauchy data, the space of possible Cauchy data itself. I think on the space of Cauchy data, there is a natural symplectic form.
Okay.
So I'm not.
Because I'm trying to answer the question. So like, what data do I need to like to determine the, if I start from Lagrangian, so which ingredients do I need to determine the symplectic form?
Just the Lagrangian. Lagrangian.
General, yeah.
With, you know, with whatever gauge, you know, it has to have gauge symmetry and so on. One has to redo this kind of analysis in the presence of gauge symmetry. It's a bit more complicated, but just take your Lagrangian, and then you just look at the space of solutions of the equations of motion. So this is the same as the Cauchy data. You know, you need to specify my field at the initial time, together with some number of derivatives, depending on the form of the Lagrangian. And then this slightly funny maneuver, by thinking about the action functional on an interval, that determines the symplectic form. So I must admit, this kind of algorithm, you know, the fact that the phase space is the space of solutions to equations of motion is like very clean. This particular algorithm of determining the symplectic form this way is a little opaque, I think. It's a traditional way of doing it. There are other ways of getting at it. So before I go on, is everybody happy with the Poisson bracket on the symplectic manifold? Yeah, okay. So in our example, so is the value of my field at 0, and p is its derivative. So clearly, p is del q del t, whereas del p del t equals 0. So the Hamiltonian must satisfy h of q equals p, h of p equals 0, and well, in our symplectic form, as there's, you know, some conventions hanging around here, pq is minus 1. So in these conventions, we've ended up with a Hamiltonian, which is minus a half p squared. Well, there was some sign convention which made it negative. It doesn't matter. So of course, this is the standard answer. That one also gets by using the Legendre transform, but the reason for doing it this way is it's somewhat more general. Okay. Okay, any other questions about this? So, next I'd like to, so all of this can be applied to field theory in pretty much the same way. But I think the next thing I'd like to do is, since this derivation of the symplectic form was a little bit opaque, I want to give you another way to think about it, which I think is more transparent. And this other way is also, you know, pretty general. Drive the Poisson bracket. So the coordinates on the phase space are operators in the system. So e.g., here, they are, you know, I measure my field at 0, I measure its derivative at 0. Or in gauge theory, we might measure, do some gauge invariant measurements of the field strength or something. Or in gravity, we might have to do something more complicated with, you know, whatever. Gravity is a little more complicated because the kind of measurements you can do always involves something going off to spatial infinity. we need. To give a Poisson bracket on operators. So how is this defined? I take one operator, O2 operators, then the Poisson bracket So I take my two operators, and I have one at time 0, one at time t, and I move the position of 1 cross 0, and what we're interested in is the discontinuity. So that's the Poisson bracket. So we have to think about this, you know, in some quantum mechanical system. This is a very reasonable thing to do. Like, I have some quantum mechanics. I first do one thing, and then I do another. Or I do it in different orders. You get different answers. And that's the Poisson bracket. But the caution is, we need to work semi-classically. Well, I like the leading non-trivial contribution. Yeah. In principle, this expression will have all kinds of complicated things coming from the commutator of operators. We're just looking at that, some leading non-trivial terms. So let's see how this works in our system. So I want to consider product, for example, phi prime at 0 with phi at t. Yeah, wait, sorry, let me do it the other way around. It actually doesn't matter. So we'll take so this product of operators, this has a contribution like this. There is the propagator. So of course, what I'm deriving is the canonical commutation relations. The reason I want to do this is I'm always a bit dissatisfied is when you take a quantum field theory course, they just declare that these are true, but that's not really satisfying from a first principles perspective, but you can actually derive them from the path integral, and that's what we're doing. Okay. So, well, we need to figure out the propagator of this system in order to do this computation. Unless, are there any questions? Yeah?
Do these operators live in the tangent space? Because they take fields and output numbers? Or?
No, they're just functions on the space of fields. An operator, you know, my field is something wheeling around space-time. I'm measuring it in some region. It's temperature. Like, what's the average temperature in this box? It takes my field, which is temperature, it gives you a number. I think in general, we're doing things because that's how things are normally done in PSI, emphasizing a Lorentzian perspective, but it's often more transparent, easier to think about, to use the fact that, you know, quantum field theory is just statistical mechanics. So there's really nothing quantum going on here. If I rotate the Schrodinger equation, I get the heat equation, and there's also canonical commutation relations appearing in the heat equation. Okay, so I have my two operators. I measure my field at zero. And again, you can think of your field as a quantum particle, or you can think of it as literally a Brownian particle you might see under your microscope. It's the same thing, really, if I'm in Newtonian signature. You have a little piece of pollen being moving around randomly. So I measure the position of my Brownian particle here, and I measure its derivative at some, in this case, future time. Well, so what's the propagator? The propagator satisfies, well, it's always a source for the equations of motion. So, in other words, P, this is what we get by solving equations of motion with a source. Phi of zero. And if we do that with the we vary phi and integrate by parts, we get this equation. Okay, are you guys happy with this? I'm not quite sure how you, when you took a quantum field theory class, how did you describe the propagator in quantum field theory on momentum space? Did you guys discuss the propagator?
Yeah.
Yeah, but was it the
function?
Yes, but did you compute it by momentum space methods?
Yeah, Fourier transform.
Yeah, so this is just, this is the Fourier, you know, this is P squared, Mm-hmm. The Fourier transform of this is 1. So this is the Fourier transform of that. For these thing we're doing, we're looking at operator products, it's better to work in space-time because our operators are at specific positions in space-time, not at specific momentum. Okay, so what's the solution to this equation? P of t is 1/2 delta function t is positive times t. Okay, so if I differentiate this twice, the first derivative here will think of a delta function when it goes there, and that's 0. And the first derivative, so the only term with one derivative is when it hits there. And then I differentiate again. The derivative of this gives me that. No, this should be 2, sorry. OK, so what's the two-point function? Phi 0, phi prime at t is minus 2 delta function t is greater than equal to 0. And because I'm differentiating there, I lose this factor of t. So this has a discontinuity. Oh, I know. Yeah, this shouldn't be there. Sorry. I'm messing up my factors off. Yeah, because when you vary the equations of motion, you get a factor of 2, which cancels that factor off. Sorry. OK. This is a discontinuity when we cross the origin. So we conclude that position p is minus 1. As before, up to some sign convention. So this is how canonical commutations always appear. You do one measurement, you do another one at some future time, and I look at the other order, and that's they're not the same because of something like this. And this is maybe a cleaner way to get to the Poisson bracket and therefore to the symplectic form. So from this point of view, the symplectic form is the inverse of the Poisson bracket. OK, any questions? So Giuseppe, was this these lectures meant to be 50 minutes or an hour?
An hour.
Oh, OK. Great, so now we have some simple examples, like a very simple example of how we build the phase space by starting with the Lagrangian. But I've only derived it for really excessively trivial Lagrangians, that of just a free particle. So let's We do the analysis with an honest field theory. So I'm going to consider, for example, a two-dimensional scalar field. And the Lagrangian is and theta is periodic. So what we'd like to do is repeat this analysis and derive the phase space and the Hamiltonian for this system. Now, of course, this is del t squared minus del theta squared, because we're in Lorentzian signature. And here's the crucial fact. Any solution to the equations of motion, which is defined in series and t, actually extends for all t. Okay, so this is not true. So why is this a useful thing? This tells you that if you give me the Cauchy data, which is the data of a solution, the equations of motion for a very small time, that actually there is a unique solution for all time. So that the PDE, given the equation of motion, is a well-posed PDE. The solutions don't suddenly develop weird singularities. In Euclidean signature, that's false. It's easy to write down harmonic functions, which seem to be doing fine, and then develop poles. So there's a kind of slightly subtle distinction between how one analyzes phase space in Euclidean versus Lorentzian. Lorentzian, we look at solutions defined for all time. And in Euclidean, that's not so great. You look at solutions which are defined for just some very small times. Okay, so if I want to solve the equations of motion, phi t theta . So we look at some phi solving the equations of motion, and I Taylor expand it. So then the equations of motion give us relations between these terms. So del t squared phi equals del theta squared phi means del theta squared phi of 0 is equal to phi of 2. So that the only phi of 0 and phi of 1 are independent. Once you give me those, the next term is obtained by differentiating phi of 0 twice. And this term is obtained by differentiating phi of 2 twice. And this term is obtained by differentiating phi of 0 four times, and so on. So all the phi of n are determined by phi of 0, phi of 1. So the phase space has coordinates . So we can I'll call these Q of theta and P of theta just by analogy with what we had before. And we can expand PQ into Fourier modes let's see. Well, maybe I'm going to get to the end of this, but we can calculate like the symplectic form. Is, let's see. Looks like that. And the Hamiltonian looks like that. So we'll figure out this calculation next time. But the analysis is just really just the same kind of thing that we've already done. Okay, any questions?
Could you just repeat that last part? How did you get, you said we need to go through some calculation steps. Could you maybe just?
Yeah. I was just writing in the answer, and I thought we would go through the calculation next time. Okay. But it's so to find the symplectic form, there's two ways to do it. One is to view, what Qn is an operator. It's where I average my field against this. I mean, e to the minus that. And then I look at the thing sourced by that. I can compute the two-point function of these operators where I average my fields. And you find there's a term which has a discontinuity that gives me the Poisson bracket, which is the inverse of this. If you prefer, you could use the variational one form. And for the Hamiltonian, then once you know the symplectic form, you know the Hamiltonian because you know how, this is U, this is P, this is the first derivative of this, and when I differentiate it again, I get here, which is d theta squared, and that d theta squared is a certain eigenvalue, n squared. So because of that eigenvalue of like 2 pi squared n squared, you get this term. That's like it has a mass, there's a mass term. Right?
So the fact about like the Lambertian and Laplacian, we use this fact to come up with an ansatz, right? It's like to look perturbative, right?
Yes, exactly.
Can you explain that point? Like, how does that motivate that ansatz?
Okay. Well, I suppose there's a couple of different ways you might think about what the phase space is. Is it the phase space solutions which extend for all time, or solutions which extend just for some small amount of time? So fortunately, in Lorentzian signature, there's no difference. We just say it's solutions which extend for all time. And now, this fact says, because solutions that extend for all time are the same thing as solutions that just work for very small time, it's easier to compute the latter, because that's just a problem in algebra. I just need to look at the coefficients.
Just to sum up the lecture, so like in contrast to mathematical physics one, here we are learning how to define this symplectic structure for field theories, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's one of the topics. I also want to discuss. Given the symplectic manifold. What can we say about the quantum system, and in particular the Hilbert space? So geometric quantization, which was not discussed in, you didn't do anything about geometric quantization.